Judges chapter 21. The men of Israel had taken an oath at Mizpah. Not one of us will give his daughter in marriage to a Benjamite. The people went to Bethel, where they sat before God until evening, raising their voices and weeping bitterly. "Lord, God of Israel," they cried, "why has this thing happened to Israel? Why should one tribe be missing from Israel today?" Early the next day, the people built an altar and presented burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. Then the Israelites asked, "Who from all the tribes of Israel has failed to assemble before the Lord?" For they had taken a solemn oath that anyone who failed to assemble before the Lord at Mizpah was to be put to death. Now the Israelites grieved for the tribe of Benjamin, their fellow Israelites. "Today one tribe is cut off from Israel," they said. "How can we provide wives for those who are left, since we have taken an oath by the Lord not to give them any of our daughters in marriage?" Then they asked, "Which one of the tribes of Israel failed to assemble before the Lord at Mizpah?" They discovered that no one from Jabesh Gilead had come to the camp for the assembly. And when they counted the people, they found that none of the people of Jabesh Gilead were there. So the assembly sent 12,000 fighting men with instructions to go to Jabesh Gilead and put to the sword those living there, including the women and children. "This is what you are to do," they said. "Kill every male and every woman who is not a virgin." They found among the people living in Jabesh Gilead 400 young women who had never slept with a man, and they took them to the camp at Shiloh in Canaan. Then the whole assembly sent an offer of peace to the Benjamites at the rock of Rimmon. So the Benjamites returned at that time and were given the women of Jabesh Gilead who had been spared. But there were not enough for all of them. The people grieved for Benjamin, because the Lord had made a gap in the tribes of Israel. And the elders of the assembly said, "With the women of Benjamin destroyed, how shall we provide wives for the men who are left? The Benjamite survivors must have heirs," they said, "so that a tribe of Israel will not be wiped out. We can't give them our daughters as wives, since we Israelites have taken this oath, 'Cursed be anyone who gives a wife to a Benjamite.' But look, there is an annual festival of the Lord in Shiloh, which lies north of Bethel, east of the road that goes from Bethel to Shechem, and south of Lebanon." So they instructed the Benjamites, saying, "Go and hide in the vineyards and watch. When the young women of Shiloh come out to join in the dancing, rush from the vineyards, and each of you seize one of them to be your wife. Then return to the land of Benjamin. When their fathers or brothers complain to us, we will say to them, 'Do us the favor of helping them, because we did not get wives for them during the war.' You will be guilty of breaking your oath because you did not give your daughters to them." So that is what the Benjamites did. While the young women were dancing, each man caught one and carried her off to be his wife. Then they returned to their inheritance and rebuilt the towns and settled in them. At that time, the Israelites left that place and went home to their tribes and clans, each to his own inheritance. In those days, Israel had no king, and everyone did as they saw fit.
We began our journey through the Judges, I said we would hear these words in the background.
Great is thy faithfulness.
The inspiration for that song came out of a much older song written around 3,000 years ago. We find in the Book of Lamentations, where the prophet Jeremiah writes, "Because of your great love, we are not consumed. And that's the kind of the background soundtrack to the book of Judges. And it's my prayer that we will hear those words afresh, that we will hear them with great richness as a result tonight. But to hear them, as I said before in the service, we must enter the final story of Judges. It's not the happiest of stories. We may even ask, what on earth possessed God to place this story in the pages of the Bible? Well, I think it's recorded so that we might see God's robust and thought-defying love. Let me see if I can explain it in this way. There are two ways to view the love of God. One is what I'm going to call the Hallmark card view of God. It's pristine, it's clean lines. There may be an image that has soft edges on the front of the card, and someone might write a card with their handwriting, their own handwriting. I know that's a dying art, at least it dies in my hand if you ask my PA. And you might write a note, and you might receive a Hallmark card from someone who's very special. And you might start to get all gooey inside, kind of like the image on the outside of the card, all warm and fuzzy, because someone loves me, is what you say. Okay, and even the guys do this. Oh, someone loves me, she loves me, she loves me. Until some other guy catches you doing that, and you go, oh, I know nothing. But a girl gets it, or a wife might get a Hallmark card, and she is left yet again in that breathless wonder that says, out of all the earth, he has chosen me. That's the Hallmark card love. And it's genuine. There is no doubt about that. The second view of love does not come with clean lines. It's seen only in the muck and the mire of life. The best illustration I have for this is that one of my bishops, a guy I served under, told me a story quite a number of years ago about he and his wife going to a church as part of their ministry. And in the church, they went to old wooden pews, the kind of thing you might see on TV shows and stuff, just wooden pews. And somewhere in the church, the bishop's wife noticed that there was a woman sitting on her own and kind of hunched a little and looking a little miserable. And so the bishop's wife went and sat next to her and struck up a conversation. And as they were talking, it became clear that this woman was deeply distressed and quite distraught. And so the bishop's wife put her arm around this woman and embraced her and assured her that it didn't matter what she'd done or what had happened, she was welcome in this church because it's a family of God and God welcomes everybody. As the bishop's wife was embracing and talking, this distraught woman became so distressed, she went into body heaving sobbing and lost control of bodily functions. But the bishop's wife did not let her go, kept embracing her and assuring her that she was much loved, even though both women were sitting in the puddle of one. That is a robust, thought-defying love. It says, no matter what you've become, no matter what you've done, you're welcome here. This is home. That's the expression of love I hope we end up with at the very end of this message. But to see it again, we must enter the story. There's simply no other way to see that love unless we enter the story. Now, much of the story is unpleasant, and we might be taken to places that cause us to wince. There's a certain section in this story, if I think about it too long, a 50-year-old memory plays right here for me. It may be that you experience a deep unease. And if that happens, then again, there are people with yellow lanyards on who are willing to talk to you. And if you feel like you need to leave the room, it's okay. It really is okay. But if you can, stay with me to the end so that you will see that our God has a great faithfulness towards us. Now, Judges 19 is where we're going to start. Judges 19 begins with the story of one couple and then leads us on a journey which shows us that their story draws the whole nation into civil war. We're going to spend most of our time with the couple, Because understanding their story gives us the keys to understand the rest of Judges. So, Judges 19, verse 1. In those days, Israel had no king. Now, a Levite who lived in a remote area of the hill country of Ephraim took a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. But she was unfaithful to him. Unfaithful is a sanitized word. The old King James Version translated it much more strongly. She slept around. Why she did, we're not sure. But there is enough evidence in what we will see of him to indicate that his behaviour didn't lend itself to encouraging her to be faithful. So we read on, verse 2. She left him and went back to her parents' home in Bethlehem, Judah. And after she'd been there 4 months, her husband went to persuade her to return. That is, in the original language, he went to speak tenderly to her heart. And that he was serious about doing that and having her return, he takes two donkeys, one for him, one for her, to ride on to go back home. We pick up the story in verse 4. His father-in-law, the woman's father, prevailed on him to stay. So he remained with him 3 days, eating and drinking and sleeping there. And on the fourth day, they got up early and prepared to leave. But the woman's father said to his son-in-law, refresh yourself with something to eat because you haven't had enough over the last 3 days. Have another day's belly full. And so the two of them sat down and they ate and drank together. And afterwards, the woman's father said, please stay tonight and enjoy yourself. It's a bit like going to my mum's home, this scene. If you go to my mum's home, if you would come with me, we might get there around about breakfast. She lives in Toowoomba. We could get there as she's cleaning up for breakfast. She notices the car, pulls up the driveway. She puts the pot on, boiling water, and puts another teaspoon of tea in the teapot, fills it up, and says, come sit down and have a cup of tea. And you sit down, and before you know it, you've had a cup of tea, morning tea, lunch, dinner, and dessert is on the way, and you've not left the table. It is just one honking feast. I feel like I'm in a tin can here. Am I the only one? I'll just keep going. So the only difference between my mum and this father-in-law is he outdoes my mum. He brings food out for 4.5 days. And then in verse 10, on the fifth day, the Levite has enough. He says, no, we're going to leave. And by the time he convinces his father-in-law to leave, it's in the afternoon. And so they're going to make a journey from where they're living in Bethlehem, Judah, all the way back to his home in Ephraim. It's a bit of a journey. And so they work their way back. And we're told that the man saddles up his donkeys and then takes his concubine. And you notice the order of list here. Donkeys first, concubine last. Clearly, he had persuaded her to go back with him, but I do wonder if the Levite spoke tenderly to her heart, or did he simply take possession of her? Pick it up in verse 11. While they were near Jebus, the day was almost gone. Jebus is the old ancient site which we now know as Jerusalem. And so the servant said to the master, come, let's stop in the city of the Jebusites and spend the night there. The master said, no, we won't go into any city whose people are not Israelites. We will go on to Gibeah. He added, come, let's try and reach Gibeah or Ramah and spend the night in one of those places. And so they went on, and as the sun set, they neared Gibeah in Benjamin, and there they stopped to spend the night. They go into the city square and sit there. The expectation, the custom of the day was if you go sit in the city square and you're obviously travelling, someone from the town would be hospitable and invite you to their place to spend the night at their place, because to spend the night in the city square is not safe. It's not the best thing to do. And people wanted to be hospitable, but we're told no one invited them to their home until an old man, a migrant worker, comes into the city square on his way back from the fields. And he asks these travellers, why are they sitting in the town square? And after hearing the story, which I've just relayed, the old man says in verse 20, in the ancient language, shalom lach, which are words that we are hearing more and more in our TV shows and Netflix and so on the lips of Middle Eastern people, because it's a greeting. It's shalom lach. It's you're welcome in my home. Because the Middle Eastern people are much more hospitable than we are. And so the old man offers his home as a place for the night. And a home is where you find food. It's at a family table. It's where you find a warm bed. It's safety. And once the front door is closed on the home and you are safely on the inside, the front door stands guard against the nighttime and any evil that might come. And so in verse 22 we read, and they're enjoying themselves. This is a replay of what happened in the Levite's father-in-law's house. There is food, there is drink, there is laughter, there is talking. It's safe. Until verse 22, the second half. While they're enjoying themselves, some of the wicked men of the city surrounded the house and pounding on the door. They shouted to the old man who owned the house, "Bring out the man who's come into your house so that we can have sex with him." Now here, friends, shades of Sodom fall across this story. Back in Genesis chapter 19 is the story of Sodom, where men demanded the same thing of Lot, who had guests in his home. But this is not Sodom. This city is Gibeah. It belongs to the Benjamites. It belongs to God's people. As the shade of Sodom falls, we realize that Sodom has come to God's people. And they were not interested in offering a safe place or hospitality. Now, like Genesis 19, the old man tries to remind them, as Lot did, that this was not acceptable. In verse 23, the owner of the house went outside and said to them, "No, my friends, don't be so vile. Since this man is my guest, don't do this outrageous thing." But the men won't have a bar of it. They cared only for themselves. They had needs, and their needs must be satisfied. Which is no doubt why the New Testament, the NIV, calls these men wicked men. The word wicked in the original language is used in the Psalms a few times to describe a disease that leads to death, or death, or Sheol, hell. Wicked has to do with Sheol, it has to do with hell. When the Apostle Paul was writing in the New Testament to the church in Corinth, he picked up this idea to describe the ruler of hell. And he wrote these words, "What harmony is there between Christ and Belial? What harmony is there between Christ and the Satan?" So wicked men here in Judges 19 could be translated, as it is in some other translations, it could be translated, sons of Belial, sons of the evil one. And these are Benjamites. These are God's people. And just as Lot did in Sodom, so the old man does here. He says in verse 24, "Look, here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. I'll bring them out to you. And you can use them and do whatever you wish." I'm a dad. I have a daughter. What possesses a father to say that? While I struggle with that, while you struggle with that, we read the end of verse 24, the old man says, "But as for this man, don't do such an outrageous thing." So, my daughter Emma tells me that in her church in Vancouver, they read this Bible passage in church. And as they did, it was being read by a professor at her Bible college. And as he got to this point, he began to weep. How else do you read this passage? Verse 25, "But the men would not listen to the old man. Their intentions were clear. And then the Levite, the fine specimen of humanity that he was, we're told, took his concubine and sent her outside to them. And then they did as the old man suggested. They were, if you have your Bible there, back in chapter 17, verse 6, they were men, these sons of Belial, who did what was right in their own eyes. Right here, the echoes of Sodom fall silent, because right here, things have moved way beyond Sodom. Here in Judges, there are no angels to strike the sons of Belial blind. There are no angels to protect the host or his virgin daughter. At daybreak, she makes her way back to the home, and there's this awful description. She falls down at the door with her hands on the threshold. Her hands come to rest on the very, almost at the threshold, you know, the bit just before the door, at the very threshold of the place that was supposed to keep her safe. She falls, her hands touch the place where she should have been protected. But this story tells us that one of the most fundamental institutions in Israelite society, the home, has failed her. Women ought to be safe in every home. That's a large part of why we have homes. Children ought to be safe in our homes, our schools, our workplaces and churches. But two royal commissions have exposed a shadow hanging over far too many Australian institutions, including churches in our denomination. Research tells me that 24% of women aged 18 to 22 experience sexual harassment at work and in our shopping centres every day. The Levite's exceptional character shines through once more in verse 28. See what he says? He comes out of the door, sees his concubine. He was going to go home. He wasn't expecting her to make it back. He sees her there and he says, "Get up, let's go." That's called speaking tenderly to the heart. I'm being very facetious right there. "Get up, let's go." There was no answer, so he puts her on a donkey. He reaches home, and then he does the unthinkable. He dissects her and sends her body parts all over Israel. Even in death, he fails to care for this woman. He uses her to begin a civil war, because what he did was done to animals when someone thought it was time to go to war. But he does it to this woman. And then we read at the end of chapter 19 and the beginning of chapter 20, people said, no one has seen or done anything like this since the days the Israelites came out of Egypt. Just imagine, we must do something. Speak up." Or another way of saying is, "No one's ever done this before. Think of her." And I read this story over and over and over again, and I think of her. I can't forget her. And every time I got to this point in my preparation during the week, every time, I could not finish. I had to get up. I just felt like grime and crud was clinging to my skin, and there was a weight that was crushing my soul, and my mind was going numb. And I wondered over and over again, will I really hear the music in the background that says, "Great is thy faithfulness, Lord, unto me." And then a chilling thing went through my mind. Will I be able to lead St. Paul's to that place? Well, after much reflection, the words will come, and they do come, but we need to sit with the story just a little longer. Let me ask you a question. Did you notice in the story so far that no one has a name? Have you noticed that? We have a Levite, we have a concubine, we have a father-in-law and an old man. But no one has a name. Let me work from a man called Daniel Block for a moment. He has some really helpful statements. He says, "The namelessness of the characters reflects the dehumanization of the individual in a Canaanized world. To have a name is to be somebody. To have a name is to have significance within a community. But anonymity erodes the value of the individual and declares the failure of the community to speak up, to name them. And the irony is that in a world where the individual is the measure of all things, the individual counts for nothing. And once more, Judges becomes a confronting mirror to us. For do we not live in a time when self is the measure of all things? Apart from the anonymity, I have another question. Did you notice the silence? You see, the Lord has not spoken once in this story. Not once. He has not inserted himself into the story. He is conspicuous by his absence. I think he's silent because he is angry and he is in deep distress over his people. And why wouldn't he be? His people have out-sinned Sodom. The Levites' call to the civil war means that the leaders of Israel gather, and 400,000 soldiers gather armed to the eye teeth. And they want to go out against Gibeah and rectify, sort this out. When they discover that the sons of Belial lived in a place called Gibeah, they send a detachment down to Gibeah and they say, cough up the guys who did this. Let's have them. And then the whole town of Benjamin said, no. Benjamin, you see, would rather side with the sons of Belial, the sons of the evil one, than with God's people. They would rather protect the guilty of heinous crime than sit and seek the justice of the victims. Now, of course, that never happens in our day, does it? The civil war comes to an end only after 65,000 fighting men have lost their lives. And after, if you come across to chapter 20 and verse 48, after the men of Israel put all the towns of Benjamin to the sword, including the animals and everything else they found, and then they set all the towns on fire. There were only 600 Benjamin men left after this. 600. Only 600. No women, no children, no towns, just 600 men, scared as anything, sitting on a big rock, and each one without a wife. And because of the vow taken by everyone else in Israel not to give their daughters to the Benjamites, this tribe of Benjamin stands on the very precipice of extinction. And this brings a new challenge. Israel works all the angles to find a solution. They can't let a tribe go into extermination. And so they work out two solutions. One is to take on another small group of Israelites, kill everybody except women who have never been with a man. And they take those women and give them to the Benjamites, and then they realize they're 200 short. And so they then, there's a festival up the road, and there'll be a whole lot of young women up there who've never, they're virgins, so why don't we send 200 Benjamites up there and they can take whoever they want. And so that's how they make up the shortfall. The story opens with one woman before us and it ends with 600. In the words of one commentator, what was done to the least of women has now been done to many. And then the pathos of the whole mess rings out in two sentences right at the very end of Judges in verses 23 and 24. The Benjamites returned to their inheritance and rebuilt the towns and settled in them. And at the time, the Israelites left the place and went home and to their tribes and clans and each to their own inheritance. You think, what? It's just like normal? Is that what it is? Is this just normal? Now, can I hasten to add here, despite what feminists will say, none of this has God's approval. Not one word in this story has God's approval. Not one. His silence, which is the other side of his wrath, tells us as much. What we see here is not how life is supposed to be. None of this tells us how society is supposed to work. It tells us the exact opposite. This story tells us what happens when men and women do what is right in their own eyes. And the last sentence of Judges makes that extraordinarily, painfully clear. Verse 25, in those days Israel had no king and everyone did as they saw fit. Now, in the Bible that I work from to prepare sermons and do my devotions in, that sentence ends two-thirds of the way down the page. The rest of the page is blank. And part of me wants to go, where's the rest of the story? Why is there a third of the page blank? What did the editors do? What were they thinking? Because I get to the end of the story of Judges and my soul says, surely there's a king. Surely there has to be another way. This is not how life is supposed to be. For crying out loud, this is not how it's supposed to be. And right there, if I listen, I start to hear, great is thy faithfulness. I start to hear it. You see, when Sodom sinned, God wiped it out. But he doesn't wipe out his people. He does not deal with Israel as her sins demand. And so we hear a great love song start to play from Lamentations. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. His compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. And when we turn the pages in our Bibles, we come to the book of Ruth. And if we follow the story of Ruth, this delightful short story, we find that she ends up being married to a man called Boaz, a true man of God, very different to the Levite. And when they marry, they have a son, and the son becomes the father of Jesse, and Jesse becomes the father of David, the great King David of the Old Testament. And we start to get excited, but then we realize David had clay feet. So is there not a king? 1,000 years after David walked the earth, we are told his greatest son walked the earth. And this one, Jesus, who though being very nature did not consider equality with God something to be used to his advantage, rather he made himself nothing, taking on the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. He sat down next to us in our mess and reached out to us to say, no matter what you've done, no matter what you've become, there's a place to call home. Come home. And then we're told in Philippians chapter 2, verse 8, and being found in the appearance of a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. And more than that, the New Testament tells us, God made Jesus, who had no sin, to be sin for us. That is, when Jesus was crucified, he took the punishment for sin. He bore the full measure of God's wrath. God did not pour out his wrath on the sons of Belial. He poured it out on Jesus, his son. God did not pour out his wrath on Israel. He poured it out on his son, Jesus. God did not pour out his wrath on us. He poured it out on his son, Jesus, which is why the New Testament says Jesus came into the world to save sinners. And I pause and I have to take a breath, because our only response is to sit in humble adoration and sing, great is thy faithfulness. Is there a king? Yes, there is a king. There is a king. And over and over and over again, the Bible says to us, because of his great love, we are not consumed. And right here, I'm grateful that God did not wipe out Israel back at the end of Judges. Because if he had, there would not have been a Jesse. There would not have been a David. There would not have been a Jesus the King. But because of his great love, we are not consumed. And I want to hear that over and over and over again. I need to hear over and over again, it does not matter what you've done, it doesn't matter what you've become, there's a place to call home, come. And who does not need to hear that over and over again? Who does not need to hear that? And our only response can be to sit in humble adoration and sing, "Great is thy faithfulness, Lord, unto me. All I have needed, thou hast provided. Great is thy faithfulness, Lord, unto me." And so as we sit, we're going to sing that grand old hymn, "Great is thy faithfulness." Join Gary in the tent. Is there a king? Ah, yes, there's a king. His name is Jesus. And the New Testament, when they discover that Jesus has come, they speak in the profoundest of terms. Light has come into the world, and the world gets to live by the light of Jesus. And with Jesus comes a change in society. He sets up a new kingdom, a kingdom in which Matthew tells us that those who mourn will be comforted, and those who seek and hunger for righteousness will be satisfied. And a kingdom in which God's people will be salt to arrest the decay of the world around us, and who will be light to the world so that others will come into God's marvelous light. And in this kingdom, women will not be treated as objects of desire or goods and chattels. Rather, they'll be loved and protected and honored. As the men in the kingdom of God love women like Jesus loved women. And of course, it's not just the women who will be cared for and honored, but in the new kingdom that Jesus is establishing, enemies are loved, not exterminated. Even when enemies are found amongst God's people, small tribes are not threatened with annihilation, but rather they are met with the same kind of robust, paradigm-shifting love that Jesus has loved us with, that says to them, no matter what you've become, no matter what you've done, this is home. I wanted us as a church to go through the journey of Judges so that we might see how great our God is, and that we might respond with humbled adoration and renew our commitment to be his people, that we might take on his calling, for he has chosen us to be his people, and that we would therefore live lives that are remarkably different to the lives of people around us. We've looked into the confronting mirror so that when we see things that need to be adjusted, we might adjust them. For we are on mission. And next year we will be in mission. We are a people of God that he is using to call people out of darkness. So brothers and sisters, take up God's call. For you are God's chosen people, a royal priesthood, God's treasured possession, so that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. We're going to close our service by singing, "How Great is Our God." And as we do that, we'll worship not just in song, but also in our offertory. Because the offertory we receive helps pay for the work of the kingdom here. We want Jesus' name to be famous here and around the world. And so the last thing you'll hear are your voices in this service. When the song ends, we are done. We want to worship our great God. For because of his great love, we have not consumed. Jesus was. So that we might live.